Design Fest and seeing all of you here, I just said to Michael we should seriously consider extending this for another 3 weeks. On condition that there be no further bistro banters after today. which reminds me, if I don't get around to mentioning it, Professor Horowitz and Professor Stachel and Professor Eckert will be joining me at 4 o'clock today for the last bistro banter. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Gary Horowitz, Professor of Physics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Horowitz received his BA from Princeton University and his PhD from University of Chicago, and he held postdoctoral fellowships at Oxford and the Institute for Advanced Studies before moving on to his professorship, his permanent professorship at Santa Barbara. Professor Horowitz is a world-leading expert in both classical and general relativity and superstring theory, and has pioneered many advances in our detailed understanding of black holes, space-time singularities, and various other sophisticated aspects of fundamental mathematical physics. We are delighted to welcome him here to Einstein Fest to talk about strange views of space-time, from Einstein to string theory. I dare say I can think of no better guide for this wonderful adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Gary Horowitz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Most people probably don't think much about space and time unless they're in short supply, like when you don't have enough space in your closet or your garage to store everything you want to put there, or you don't have enough time in the day to do everything you'd like to do. But what really is space and time? And when you think about it, they seem rather mysterious, especially time. So here are some of the mysteries of time. Does time have a beginning? Can it end? Can you make time go faster or slower? Is time travel possible? Modern physics has given us answers to many of these questions. In fact, it's given us a new view of space and time, which seems very strange. It's strange because it's counterintuitive. It seems to conflict with our common sense, everyday notion of what space and time are like. But experiments have actually confirmed many of these new properties of space and time. And I'd like to tell you about these strange properties today. So let me begin with the notion of a dimension. The dimension is simply how many numbers that you need to specify a location. So if we think about the surface of the Earth, the equator is one-dimensional. You need to specify only one number to specify a location on the equator, namely the longitude. The surface of the Earth altogether is, of course, two-dimensional. You need to specify two numbers, the latitude and longitude, to specify a location on the Earth. The space above the Earth is three-dimensional. If I want to tell you the location of a hang glider, I need to give you the latitude, longitude, and altitude. But mathematically, there's no reason to stop at three dimensions. A four-dimensional space is simply a space in which you need to specify four numbers to specify a location in that space. A five-dimensional space would be one in which you need to specify five numbers, etc. In fact, I claim you already know an example of a four-dimensional space. So let's define an event just to be an occurrence that happens in a small region of space at a definite time. In other words, an event is like a snap of your fingers or a clap of your hands. And now the collection of all events, if I want to specify an event, I need to give you four numbers. I need to tell you where it happens in space and when it happens in time. So this collection of all events is an example of a four-dimensional space. Now, Einstein is famous for saying that space and time together form a four-dimensional continuum. But I claim that's nothing new. It's something you've known all along. It's simply the statement that space is three-dimensional and time is one-dimensional. Now, Einstein, of course, did do something very new and quite revolutionary. In fact, he did two things. The first is his special theory of relativity. This gave us a new view of space and time with many surprising properties. So one property of Einstein's special theory of relativity is that nothing can travel faster than light. Now, you're used to seeing examples of speed limits like the one on the left. That requires police to enforce, and it's frequently violated. But the speed limit on the right doesn't require any law enforcement. This is a law of nature and cannot be violated. Of course, this is a very, very high speed, 300,000 kilometers per second. But special relativity tells us that nothing can travel faster than that speed. And even though it's very high, the important point is that it's finite. And this is a qualitative change from our pre-relativistic notions of space and time. Before special relativity, it was thought that any event which happens after any other event, you know, you could get to. You could sort of travel arbitrarily quickly and reach any other event as long as it happened after the event you started at. That's no longer true in special relativity. There's a fundamental upper limit on how fast anything can travel, and so there are events in which, even in principle, you cannot travel or send a signal from one to another. Now, you might ask, how do we know that this is true? And I claim that this is tested every day in particle accelerators around the world. So the highest energy accelerator in the world today is the Tevatron at the Fermilab National Accelerator, located in Illinois, near Chicago. And in this accelerator, protons are pushed on and accelerated by electromagnetic fields. And they're pushed harder and harder, and they get closer and closer to the speed of light. In fact, at the current energies, these protons at the Tevatron are reaching 0.999999 the speed of light. But no matter how hard you push, you can never get the protons to exceed the speed of light. And this is just one example of this property of special relativity, that nothing can travel faster than light. Another prediction of special relativity is the following. If two events occur at the same time for one observer or one person, they will occur at different times for another person in motion relative to the first. In other words, the notion of simultaneity is not an absolute fact that everybody agrees on, but is in fact a relative notion and depends on your state of motion. I know this is hard to believe, but it's actually true that people will disagree on when two events happen at the same time. Moreover, special relativity tells us that the elapsed time between two events can depend on who's measuring it. So, I mean, this is not something we are aware of in everyday life, because this effect is negligible unless you're moving very close to the speed of light. Now, you might worry that this would cause problems if people can disagree on the time separation between two events. They can, in fact, also disagree on which event happens first. So you can have two events, and one person will say, you know, event A happens before event B, and another person will say, no, no, event B happens before A. That's another prediction of special relativity. And you might think that that will cause problems with causality. But it turns out that that's only possible when these two events are situated so that no signal or no person can travel from one to the other, because of the finite upper limit on the speed given by the speed of light. So there's no problems with causality, but it certainly is a very strange new property of time. But it's not just a property of time. The same thing happens for space. In special relativity, the spatial distance between two events also depends on what person is measuring it. In other words, the length of an object is dependent on your state of motion. Very, very strange. Now, even though the elapsed time between two events and the spatial separation can depend on the person measuring it, everyone agrees on a certain combination of spatial distance and elapsed time. There's one well-defined, absolutely defined distance between events. Now, what does all this mean? It means space and time are really unified into a single entity called space-time. They are different aspects of one entity, this four-dimensional space-time. And I tried to think of a way to illustrate this for you, and this is sort of the best I could come up with. So here's an analogy. Imagine taking a ruler and sitting it on a table at some angle relative to the walls. And imagine there's some creature, like the ant up here, who lives on the edge of the table and sees objects in the center only via their projection on the shadow that they cast onto the walls. So this ant will describe the ruler in terms of the two shadows it casts on the walls. Now suppose you reach in and rotate that ruler. The length of those shadows will change. And the ant will think that there's a different object there because the shadows have changed. But we know that it's just the ruler at a different location, a different angle. So the analogy here is that one of these shadows is supposed to represent our measurement of time, and the other shadow is supposed to represent our measurement of space. The ruler itself is the invariant sort of separation between events. And when you rotate the ruler, you're simply changing the motion of the person who is observing the ruler. Now you might say, well, why are we talking about all this dependence on motion? Why don't we just define time to be the result that you get when you're at rest, when you're not moving? That seems to be the obvious thing to do. If you're at rest, you can measure the separation in time and the separation in space, and we'll call that the real time separation. Well, the problem is, there is no way to really tell if you're at rest or not. Of course, on the Earth, we can agree if you're not moving relative to the houses and the trees, you're at rest. But that's relative to the surface of the Earth. And of course, the Earth is rotating on an axis, so that's not really at rest. And if you go out in space, the claim is, away from all the stars and any other reference frame, if you're out in space and you have two people moving relative to each other at constant speeds, there's no way of deciding who is really, quote, at rest and who is really, quote, moving. And because motion is relative, there's no absolute rest. We are forced to this property that there is no absolute time separation and no absolute spatial distance between events. What you have is only this one combination of the two, this distance in space-time. Now, probably the most remarkable consequence of this unification of space and time is that the time you experience depends on your state of motion. Your watch runs slower and you age less when you're in motion. So this is not just a statement about mechanical clocks. It affects biological clocks, like you, just as well. So you can do the following thought experiment. You can take two watches, which are initially sort of synchronized, and take them to the track and leave one at the starting line and carry the other with you as you run around the track several times. When you finish, you come back and you compare your two watches, and you'll find that the one that you've carried with you doesn't agree with the one that you left at the starting line, and in fact, it's a little bit slower. You've actually aged a little less by running around the track than if you had stayed at the starting line. Now, doctors have been saying for years that jogging is good for your health, and now you know why. Of course, this effect in practice is extremely small. You would never see it with ordinary watches, and you only see an appreciable effect when you are moving close to the speed of light. But that doesn't mean that this effect hasn't been observed. It has been observed and is experimentally verified. So there are several ways of testing the fact that the time you experience actually depends on your state of motion. The first is by taking atomic clocks. Okay. Rather than watches, let's use these very high precision atomic clocks. You can take them, synchronize them, put one, say, leave one on Earth, put another in an airplane, and let it fly around the Earth a few times. When you bring it back and compare the two clocks, lo and behold, they are no longer synchronized, and the one that has been in motion is actually behind. It has measured a shorter time. Another way that this effect has been detected is through an elementary particle known as the kaon. This kaon is a very short-lived particle, so if you sort of watch it at rest in the lab, it lives a very short time and immediately decays into other particles. But when it's produced in one of those particle accelerators, it's produced moving at a very high speed. And then we see that it actually lives longer. And that's just the statement. I mean, in its frame, it's going to live just as long as it was in the lab, but its time is moving more slowly relative to us, so we see that it lives longer. Now, this gives us a way to fast forward into the future. You can imagine boarding a spaceship, travel close to the speed of light for a trip that seems to you to last just a year, and when you return to Earth, it could well turn out that everyone on Earth is 10 years older. You will have returned 10 years later as far as the Earth is concerned, whereas you will have only aged a year. Unfortunately, according to special relativity, this is a one-way trip. You can go into the future, but special relativity does not provide any way of going into the past. Well, let me now turn to Einstein's second revolutionary idea, and that is his general theory of relativity. This is the theory of gravity. So the first thing you should ask is, why do we need a new theory of gravity? After all, Newton gave us a theory of gravity which works extremely well. It explained everything from the motion of planets to falling apples. So why did Einstein work so hard to change this theory, which had been very successful? The answer is that Newton's theory is incompatible with this picture of space and time provided by special relativity. Newton's theory requires that the spatial distance between two events be well defined, and the time separation between them be well defined. But as we've discussed, that's not true in special relativity. It's not true in our world. We don't have a choice about it. They actually depend on your state of motion. So we need a theory of gravity which is compatible with this new view of space and time. And in trying to reconcile gravity with this picture of space and time, Einstein hit upon a radical idea. He realized that he could describe all the phenomena that we attribute to gravity if he simply assumed that space and time were not fixed, but could stretch or warp. So the key idea of general relativity is that matter causes space-time to stretch, warp, become curved, in other words, and that gravity is nothing but objects responding to this curvature of space and time. A good way to picture this, or to think about it, is in terms of a rubber sheet. So in this analogy, if you put a heavy object in the center of a rubber sheet, it will distort the sheet, cause it to dip in the center like this. This is supposed to represent the sun and the space around the sun. And now, if you put a smaller object in the rubber sheet, you can think of a marble moving around this heavy ball. The marble gets deflected, not because of any mysterious force at a distance called gravity. It gets deflected just because the local space that it sees is curved. Now, in our solar system, the analogy would be that the heavy ball is the sun, the little ball, say, is the planet, and the planet is moving around the sun just because of the curvature of space induced by the sun. Well, this curvature of space and time, I should add, has many consequences. One is that light traveling in the straightest possible line is bent by gravity. It's bent because that space is curved. So you can imagine a star, which is really up here. It would appear to us to be over here because light is bent. Now, to see an effect like this, you have to look at a star which is very close to the sun, because you want the light to come close to the sun to experience the largest bending. Well, usually, if a star is very close to the sun, you don't see it, because the sun is, of course, much brighter. So to see an effect like this, you need to wait for an eclipse. And there's a funny story about this. When Einstein was first developing his general theory of relativity, and he didn't have the final form correct, he made a prediction for how much light should be bent when it passes near the sun. This was in 1911, and he published a paper predicting a bending of light which was incorrect from our modern standpoint, and off by a factor of 2. In 1913, 2 years later, there was an eclipse of the sun, and an expedition was mounted to try to measure this new effect. Well, fortunately for Einstein, the weather was terrible, and they got no useful data. 2 years later, in 1915, Einstein had his final form of general relativity, recalculated this bending of light, and found the correct answer, and made the prediction we now know today. And 4 years after that, in 1919, there was another eclipse, and another expedition was mounted, got good data in good agreement with general relativity, and this really catapulted Einstein to fame. But you can imagine what would have happened if the 1913 expedition had some useful data. They would have got the data, published it, and said, well, Einstein, you're wrong. They're correct, the light is bent, but it's, you know, by a bigger amount. 2 years after that, Einstein would have said, oh, yes, yes, I found my mistake. I now have a theory in agreement with this. And it wouldn't have had anywhere near the impact that the actual 1919 expedition had. So Einstein was very lucky, and he was benefited by the weather. Well, this idea that light can be bent passing near a massive object leads immediately to the notion of a black hole. So consider a star. As you know, a star is really a hot ball of gas. It stays hot because of nuclear reactions taking place in the center of the star. Now, this can happen for billions of years, but eventually all the nuclear fuel in the center of the star is used up. After that, the star begins to cool. And when the gas gets cooler, it starts to collapse because there's no longer enough pressure to support the star against collapse just due to gravity. Now, for sufficiently massive stars, nothing can stop this collapse. They continue to shrink until gravity becomes so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape. And that's, of course, what we mean by a black hole. Now, I've just been talking about gravity becoming strong, but I also just told you that there is, in some sense, no such thing as gravity. Everything we've been calling gravity is really a manifestation of the curvature of space and time. So to say this another way, the space near a black hole is very curved. Not like that usual, that little dimple that the sun produces that was illustrated in the rubber sheet. If you have a space near a black hole, you get a very large distortion so that light coming in can get trapped and never get out. This is another way of picturing a black hole, which is provided by general relativity. So let me give you some facts about black holes. It's natural to imagine that there's some new force that we haven't thought about, something which could come in when the density gets really strong and stop the star from collapsing. Well, it's true that if you take an ordinary star and let it sort of cool and collapse, you do reach very high densities before you form a black hole. So that's a possible way out, although not one that we take very seriously. And the reason is, you don't really need high densities to form a black hole. the density you need to form a black hole goes down when you increase the mass that you're collapsing. So if you could take all the mass in our galaxy and cause it to collapse down toward the center, you would find that you form a black hole when the average density is that of air. And there's really no reason at all that collapse should stop when the mean density is so low. So that's why we don't believe there's going to be any force to stop the black holes from forming. And we believe black holes exist throughout the universe. In fact, in the center of our galaxy, astronomers have discovered a supermassive black hole, a huge black hole with a mass a million times, actually 4 million times, the mass of the Sun. Astronomers don't know how this huge black hole formed, but there's very good evidence now that it exists. In fact, there's very good evidence that there are supermassive black holes in the center of every large galaxy in the universe. So this has been seen in many cases, and there's really no good explanation yet for how these black holes formed. It's clearly tied up with the origin of galaxies themselves. Finally, you might ask, what happens to the matter after it forms a black hole? So it's collapsing down, it gets really dense, space gets really curved, light gets trapped, you form your black hole. But what about the matter that's still inside? General relativity tells us that nothing is going to stop the collapse. So that means that the matter continues to collapse down to essentially zero size. You get the mass of the Sun collapse to basically a point, producing infinite density, infinite curvature of space and time, and something that we call a space-time singularity. I'll come back to these singularities a little bit later. Well, there are many other effects of curved space-time, and let me tell you a few. So one of them is that time slows down when you're near a massive object. You are actually aging less sitting here on the surface of the Earth than you would if you were living out in space. Of course, the effect is pretty small. You gain maybe 1 second a year by living on Earth rather than living out in space. One of the many advantages, let's say, of building your home here. But this effect gets stronger when the gravitational field gets stronger, when the curvature of space gets larger. So even though it's rather small near the surface of the Earth, if you were to travel near the surface of a black hole, the effect would be very large. And in fact, in some sense, time stands still. Time moves very, very slowly near the surface of a black hole. Now, this effect that time slows down has not only been measured, it has practical applications. The global positioning system, GPS, which allows you to locate your position anywhere on the surface of the Earth, would not work if this effect was not taken into account. So the GPS consists of 24 satellites in orbit around the Earth, each one of which is equipped with a very accurate, high-precision atomic clock. Now, this clock is affected by actually two relativistic effects. There's the effect that I just mentioned, that it's not on the surface of the Earth, but it's higher up in space, so clocks are moving differently. But it's also in motion and not at rest, so its clocks are affected by that special relativistic effect as well. And it turns out that those relativistic effects are 1,000 times larger than the accuracy of the atomic clocks. So they're really easy to see. And when the first GPS satellite was launched back in 1977, there was some debate about whether these relativistic effects were real, whether they really were there. And so the engineers decided to put a switch onto the system so they could turn off the correction for the relativistic effect. So they launched the satellites, they started taking data, and within a month it was clear that relativity was right. And they had actually good confirmation of these effects of relativity within a month, tested to maybe 1%. So this is definitely being used every day in these GPS systems. And again, it is a property of our world. Another consequence of this curvature of space and time is that matter in motion produces ripples in space and time called gravitational waves. So when I move my arm here, I'm actually producing gravitational waves. But of course, I'm producing very weak waves. And to produce stronger waves, I need much more massive objects moving much more quickly. So a good example of a source of gravitational waves would be two black holes in orbit around each other, something like a binary black hole system. Those are two massive objects moving quite quickly. And when they orbit, they lose energy through this ripples of space and time, these gravitational waves. Well, there's now a worldwide effort to detect these gravitational waves. In the United States, there are two observatories which have been built, known as LIGO, stands for the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Wave Observatory. There's one located in Hanford, Washington, and the other in Livingston, Louisiana. And the way these observatories are trying to detect the waves is very simple. They essentially just take two masses hanging from the ceiling, so they're sort of just sitting there, and they very carefully measure the distance between these two objects. If a gravitational wave comes by, it changes the separation between the two masses. And if you detect that small separation, then you've detected the gravitational wave. These observatories have been operating now for a couple years. They've not yet seen these gravitational waves directly. That's not surprising, because they're not quite at the sensitivity yet where they would expect to see it. But certainly by the end of the decade, they plan to improve the sensitivity so that they will be seeing these gravitational waves. Now, even though they haven't been seen directly, there's no doubt that they exist, because astronomers have observed binary systems. Now, not a binary black hole, as indicated here, but something called the binary neutron star. So neutron stars are, again, very dense objects that are not quite as dense as a black hole, but they are nevertheless have very strong gravitational fields on their surface. These are seen in the form of pulsars, so they emit signals very rapidly that we can detect. And there is a binary neutron system, two neutron stars in orbit, which was detected first in the 1970s and monitored pretty continuously for the past 30 years. And there's no doubt that this system is losing energy. People see the two neutron stars spiraling toward each other because it's emitting some sort of radiation. And the amount of energy it's losing is exactly what you would expect from the general relativity prediction of gravitational radiation. So these gravitational waves are there. We've seen them indirectly. And hopefully, in the next 5 years or so, we'll see them directly through these gravitational wave detectors, not just in the US, but throughout the world. I should say that this would be a major sort of new window to our universe. Everything we know about the universe so far basically comes to us in what's called electromagnetic radiation. It comes to us in the form of light, or things, radiation like light, which has different wavelengths. But gravitational waves are qualitatively different. And they can come to us from regions which are just in which light is opaque. And so we would be able to see much farther and learn much more about the universe once we can tap into this new source, these gravitational waves. Well, getting back to possible consequences of this curvature of space and time, we can return to the question of time machines. Can you build a time machine in general relativity? Well, surprisingly, it's not obviously impossible, right? It's not, you know, just something which contradicts the laws of general relativity. In fact, there are space-times in general relativity which describe time travel. Solutions of Einstein's equation, which allow you, if we were living in such a world, allow you to travel backwards in time. The problem is that in all such examples, these machines have always existed. If the time machines exist sort of now, then they existed way back at the beginning. And we don't have any examples in which you build a time machine, in which time travel is not possible now, but at some point you do something and you cause time travel to become possible. And people have been studying this. It turns out, as I said, to be a rather delicate question, because it involves, you know, properties of matter and things that you have to think carefully about. Most physicists, unfortunately, have come to the conclusion that time travel is probably not possible, given the laws of nature as we understand them. But as I said, it comes close. OK, so the final application of general relativity I'd like to mention is cosmology, the study of the universe as a whole. Now, when we look out into space, we see that the distant galaxies are moving away from us. The universe is expanding. But it's important to understand what this means. This means that the distance between galaxies is getting bigger. The individual galaxies are not getting bigger. You are not getting bigger. Or at least if you are, you can't blame it on general relativity. So it's just the distance between galaxies which is getting bigger, which leads to this expansion of the universe. But what that means is that in the past, the distance was much shorter. And in fact, continuing into the past, there comes a point when there were no galaxies. Even farther into the past, there were no stars. Everything was just a hot, dense plasma. And if you continue using general relativity to go back into the past, what you discover is that the universe began a finite time ago, about 13 billion years ago, in an event in which all the matter was was essentially on top of each other at a place of infinite density, infinite temperature, infinite gravitational fields, and space-time curvature. And this is what we call the Big Bang. So it's natural to ask, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, according to general relativity, this question is meaningless. Time itself begins at the Big Bang. If there's no time, nothing can happen. Well, if you're not satisfied with that, you're not alone. There's reasons to question this prediction of general relativity. You see, the Big Bang is another example of this singularity. Like the center of black holes, these are regions of infinite space-time curvature. And according to general relativity, space and time end or begin at such a singularity. But general relativity is expected to break down before you get to these singularities. The reason is that general relativity does not include any of the effects of a theory known as quantum mechanics. Now, this is not Einstein's fault. Quantum mechanics was invented in the 1920s, after Einstein had finished his development of general relativity in 1915. And quantum mechanics deals with very small objects. It explains the motion of atoms and elementary particles, and does so extremely well. But quantum mechanics doesn't include gravity. Normally, this isn't a problem, because when you're looking at very small scales, like atoms or elementary particles, gravitational effects are usually negligible. So the inventor of quantum mechanics didn't worry about the fact that their theory didn't include gravity. Similarly, when we're testing general relativity, we're usually working on very large scales, things like galaxies or stars or maybe the universe as a whole, where the effects of quantum mechanics would be negligible. So each of these theories have their own domain. They work very well, but they're really not compatible. When we come to a singularity like what you have in the very early stages of the universe near the Big Bang, or like what you have inside a black hole when all the matter is getting crushed down to zero size. Those are situations where you have to include physics of very small objects as well as physics of very strong gravitational fields. And we need a new theory which will combine the principles of general relativity and quantum mechanics. This new theory is what's been called a quantum theory of gravity. Now, people have tried for decades to find such a quantum theory of gravity. But in the past 20 years or so, there's been significant progress. And I'd like to talk to you about string theory, a promising candidate for this unified, well, with this quantum theory of gravity. String theory has excited physicists because not only is it a promising candidate for a quantum theory of gravity, it also looks like it will unify all of the known forces and particles. So it's also a unified theory, one of the things that Einstein worked so hard on later in his life to find. So just to explain a little more about what string theory is, let's consider the building blocks of matter. One of the long-standing goals of physics is to understand what matter is made of. And so, as you know, if you look closely at matter, you see that it's made up of atoms. That's the first thing you see at a scale of about 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. This has been known for a very long time. But if you look more closely at the atom, you'll see that it consists of a nucleus surrounded by a cloud of electrons. The nucleus is maybe 10 to the minus 12 centimeters. That's much smaller. If you look closely at the nucleus, you see that it's made up of individual nucleons, which are just protons and neutrons. So they're even smaller. And then we've recently discovered that the protons and neutrons are not fundamental, but they themselves are made up of smaller objects known as quarks. And by about 1980, that's as far as we've gone. Quarks themselves seem to be point-like. And I should say that this is as far as the experimentalists have gone. As far as the, by 1980, physicists had found that all of matter was made up of the electrons, which are in the cloud around the nucleus, and the quarks, which make up the nucleus, and a couple of other particles that are much less common. Well, this is the picture as of 1980. It's also the picture today of experimental physics. So what I'm going to tell you for the rest of the talk has not yet been experimentally verified. There are reasons to believe that we're on the right track, but we still have to wait for the confirmation, which has supported everything else I've told you. All of the strange properties of space and time up to now, I would say, have been confirmed with actual observations, experiments in the lab. Okay, so string theory starts with the idea that these particles which appear point-like, the electrons and the quarks, are really one-dimensional extended objects. They are strings. And furthermore, that these particles which look different are not qualitatively different strings. They're all essentially the same kind of string vibrating in different modes of oscillation. So just as a violin string has various different harmonics and different ways you can vibrate, these little tiny strings can vibrate in different ways, and that's what we interpret as different elementary particles. So already you have the idea of unification. The different particles we see are just different states of the same underlying string. Well, I don't have time to tell you all about string theory, so what I want to do is focus on what string theory has to tell us about space and time. The first thing string theory tells us about space is that it has more than three dimensions. String theory predicts that space has 9 or maybe 10 dimensions. Now remember what that means. It simply means that to locate a point, you need to give 9 or 10 numbers. And that's it. So this space, according to string theory, is a space in which to locate points, you need to give 9 or 10 numbers, not the usual 3. Well, if space has more than 3 dimensions, where are they? Well, they're not just hidden out in space someplace, out in outer space, I should say. They're everywhere, even here in this room. The idea is that space everywhere has really 9 or 10 dimensions. So, of course, the question is, why can't you see them? Well, one answer is that string theory is just wrong. Okay? We shouldn't study it. It makes a prediction. It's not confirmed. But string theory, I should say, has a number of other attractive features which make string theorists loath to give it up just because of this minor conflict with observations. So they have ingeniously found a couple of explanations for why we haven't seen these spatial dimensions. The first is that the extra dimensions may be curled up into very small circles. So from the back of the room, this may look like a one-dimensional line, but from the front of the room, you'll see that it's actually a very thin tube, a very thin cylinder. It's really a two-dimensional surface. And the idea is that our space might be like this tube. There could be three dimensions that are very big, that we see every day, and there could be extra dimensions which are curled up in these really, really tiny circles that we haven't seen yet. And these small dimensions are very hard to see because it would take a lot of energy to actually probe such a small size. Now, this is not really new to string theory. The idea that space might have more than three dimensions and that one of the dimensions is not seen because it's very small goes back to Kaluza and Klein in the 1920s. They proposed such a model as a way of unifying the two forces that were known at the time, gravity and electricity and magnetism. So string theory borrows this idea or incorporates it, but extends it to more dimensions to include more forces that we know about today. Another possibility has come up recently for why space might have more dimensions and we haven't seen them. And this came about because of the realization that string theory is not just a theory of strings. There are other extended objects in this theory called brains. Now, the name comes from a membrane, which, you know, connotes a two-dimensional surface. But a brain doesn't have to be two-dimensional. In fact, it can have various dimensions. So in a higher dimensional space, there could be a three-dimensional surface. And we could be, the idea is that we could be living on one of these three-dimensional surfaces and not see the dimensions which are off the surface. Now, how could that be that we wouldn't notice that there was all these other dimensions around? Well, the explanation also comes from string theory. In string theory, these brains, which have been shown to exist, come with the fact that they have their own special kind of strings. See, normally we think about strings as being closed loops, like little circles, and they propagate around and they describe things. But there are also strings which have endpoints, little open strings. And the idea is that these open strings are stuck onto the brains. The endpoints cannot leave the brain, and they can only move along these surfaces. In other words, there are particles which can only live, only move along the brain and cannot get off. And so now it's a little bit more understandable how it might be that all the particles we've seen so far correspond to particles that are stuck on the brain, they cannot get off, and that we have not yet seen the extra dimensions off the brain. Well, if this is really true, then there could be another brain someplace else in this bigger space, which could have its own particles and maybe its own people. And this is something like a parallel universe. Well, when I said that the particles we've seen have not gotten off the brain, that's true for everything except gravity. Gravity, according to string theory, is not confined to the brain, but that always includes everything. Because, after all, gravity is the curvature of space, and if there's space everywhere, there's gravity everywhere. So that means that when we form a black hole, it's not really a black hole in three spatial dimensions. It's a black hole in more than three spatial dimensions. And it's recently been shown that in more than three spatial dimensions, black holes can have very surprising properties. In fact, they don't even have to be a hole. In more than three dimensions, black holes can be a ring. In other words, they can be shaped like a donut, as indicated here. Now, you might wonder, well, what keeps the donut up? Right? Why doesn't this donut just want to collapse down and become a hole again, something like a sphere? And the answer is that this donut is spinning. It's actually rotating around this direction. And if you rotate it fast enough, you can support the donut and stop it from collapsing. So this, of course, is not something we've seen, I remind you, but it is a prediction of actually just general relativity in more than three spatial dimensions, something that's motivated by string theory. This is found just a few years ago, that there was a solution of general relativity in more than three dimensions, which looks like this. So it's a stationary object. It just sits there spinning. And it has this sort of interesting property that if you encounter a black hole like this, you actually could come inside, go through the center, and come back again. And you wouldn't get trapped. You would only get trapped if you actually crossed through the surface of the donut. Then you would be stuck, and you wouldn't be able to get out again. There are other surprising properties of black holes in more than three dimensions. Some of these black holes are not stable. In other words, if you kick it, it will sort of deform and distort itself into something very different. Of course, I don't recommend actually kicking a black hole, but you know what I mean. It's not true in three dimensions. In three dimensions, if you disturb a black hole a little bit, it quickly settles down to the way it was. You can't really change its shape very much. But in higher dimensions, some of these objects are unstable. Another qualitative difference between string theory and general relativity that I was talking about earlier. In general relativity, I said that gravity is curvature of space. It's warping, stretching of space. It's basically the geometry of space. And if you have two spaces which are curved differently, which have different geometries, they are physically different. Okay, general relativity says these are just different physical situations. It turns out that strings sense geometry differently than point particles. And this has a surprising consequence that space-times which are physically different, according to general relativity, can turn out to be indistinguishable in string theory, because the strings don't sense the space-time in the same way that point particles do, or that we do in general relativity. So here's a simple example. Let's imagine that we have, again, one dimension of space curled up into a circle. But I'm going to blow up the circle so it's a little bit easier to see this time. So here we have our sort of three large dimensions that we usually think about, and the sort of, say, one extra dimension which is curled up into a circle. Well, strings are one-dimensional objects. So there's two types of strings in a space like this. There are the usual little strings, which sort of just sit here and can move around. And then there are strings which actually wind around the circle. Now, these little strings are very much like point particles. And if you want to sort of probe this sort of dimension using those, it costs a lot of energy. Just as I said, for point particles, it takes a lot of energy to see these small distances. These little strings want to live in a much bigger space. So when you put them in a tiny space, you have to use a lot of energy. The winding strings, however, are just the opposite. These are like rubber bands. When the circle is big, you have to stretch it a lot, and that costs a lot of energy. When the circle gets small, you don't stretch it very much. And so these states of the strings, which wind around, cost a lot less energy when the circle is small. Just the opposite of what happens to those states. And now it turns out that in string theory, if you had a circle of a given radius, say R, that's actually completely equivalent to a space where the circle has radius 1 over R. In other words, a very big circle is completely equivalent to a very small circle. And what happens is that these two different types of strings just interchange roles. When the circle is very small, these wound strings are the ones which are, you know, very low in energy. And when the circle is very big, these are the ones which are very low in energy. And it's not just these properties of the strings, but all the interactions when the strings collide and whatever. It can be shown that string theory just can't tell the difference between these two spaces. OK, so finally, let me return to this issue of singularities. As I said, the singularity is the region where space and time become infinitely curved, the gravitational field becomes infinitely strong, general relativity breaks down. It's long been thought and hoped that quantum gravity, this extension of general relativity to include quantum mechanics, will remove or resolve these singularities and tell us what physics is really like. And it turns out that string theory has been shown that it's been shown that some singularities are removed in string theory. Now, this happens for different reasons. So in one case, the singularities are removed just because the strings are one-dimensional extended objects. So if the singularity is a point-like singularity, the strings just aren't affected by it. They go right by, and they hardly notice it. So that's one sense, one way in which strings resolve or are not singular, even though general relativity would be singular. A second way that strings can resolve these singularities is that in some cases, the singular space-time can be completely equivalent to a non-singular space-time. I've just told you that there are cases in which two spaces with different curvatures and different stretching and warpings of space can be completely equivalent. And that can even go so far as to say that in some cases, something with an infinite amount of curvature can be equivalent to something with a finite or non-infinite amount of curvature. But now, what about the Big Bang itself? The examples in which string theory has been shown to resolve these singularities do not yet include the most interesting cases, such as the Big Bang or the singularity inside black holes. Well, we don't have a final answer for this, and there are two possibilities. So one is that there could be an earlier collapsing phase of the universe before the current expansion that we see. If this were the case, the Big Bang would really be a big bounce. We would have a collapsing phase, which then just emerged into our current expanding phase. That's a possibility. And the other possibility is that there was no previous phase. Time as we know it really did begin at the Big Bang, even in string theory, even in a theory including all the quantum corrections. Now, this is an area of very active research in string theory today. And there's a conference here at the Perimeter starting tomorrow in which people will be debating precisely this question. So I wish I could give you the answer. People are working hard to find out. But at this point, we still don't know which of these options string theory will take. So to conclude, let me return to the questions which I raised at the beginning of my talk. First, does time have a beginning? Well, as we've seen, according to Einstein and general relativity, the answer is yes. Time begins at the Big Bang. That's the initial singularity for our universe. It's where time itself begins. But as I just said, in string theory, the question is still open. Second, can time end? Well, once again, according to Einstein and general relativity, the answer is yes. Time ends inside black holes. If you follow the matter and get sort of just let it get squashed down at the point where you have infinite density, infinite gravitational fields, infinite curvature, time ends. There's no way to go forward after that point, according to general relativity. But again, in string theory, the question is still open. And people are working hard on that one also. Three, can you make time go faster or slower? Well, here everyone agrees the answer is yes. We've seen that space and time are unified. And we've seen several ways, in fact, you can slow down time. One is when you move. The time you experience is based on your motion. When you're running around the track, you're aging less. When you go close to the speed of light and come back, you've aged less. But also, there are effects of the curved space given by massive objects. When you're sitting on the surface of the Earth, you're aging less than you are out in space. Finally, is time travel possible? And here, the answer is probably only into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Horowitz. At this point, we have time for a few questions. If you put your hands up, and there are several people doing so right now, we will have our roving individuals with microphones to come. Please wait for them to come, and there are two down over here. Please wait for them to come before you ask your questions so that everybody in the audience can hear. So, gentleman right here in the blue.
Well, I just have two short questions. Why we cannot go back in time if time is just one of the dimensions, as just as spatial dimensions? Because in spatial dimension, you can go to left, to right, either direction. But time, you cannot do that. And second part is if gravity, we thought of it as a curvature of space and time, why we still call gravity as a force? What's the equivalence of force and the curvature of space and time?
Okay. So the answer to the first question is that even though time and space are unified in special relativity, they're not exactly the same thing. So I didn't say, and Einstein didn't say, that time was completely equivalent to space. And as you say, in space we know we can travel to the left or to the right, but we have a hard time going back, and we seem to only go forward. So that's explained in special relativity by treating time and space, well, slightly differently in the sense that they're not exactly on an equal footing. As I tried to indicate, they're two different aspects of one thing, but they're not exactly the same. Maybe I should sort of just leave it at that. The second question about why gravity is a force, as I said, in general relativity, you can take the view that there is no such thing as gravity. All you have is this warping of space and time. So in that case, you would never talk about a force. In Newton's day, we didn't know about general relativity, so he, you know, chose a language in which gravity was a force. But from a modern viewpoint, you really could take the view that there is no force of gravity. It's all a manifestation of this warping of space and time.
Okay, there was a question right here in the middle.
One just simple question. What is it that is bent? What is the fabric of this thing that bends under heavy, massive weights like sun or the Earth? What is it being
yeah,
bent?
Okay, so I think you're carrying the rubber sheet analogy a little bit too far. So okay, it's supposed to be an analogy. So you can look at that and you say, okay, well, we have a rubber sheet. We know that rubber sheets are made up of little things and stuff. So in general relativity, space is not supposed to be made up of anything. Space and time together are some entity. We know how to describe it through the equations and its curvature and stuff, but it is not composed of anything more fundamental. In string theory, there is a hope or a sense that maybe we will, in fact, discover what space and time are made of. Maybe in string theory we will find a way to sort of construct space and time out of something more fundamental. But that's something people are working on, and we don't have the final answer.
There's a question, this gentleman right down here.
Professor Horowitz, I wonder, you were talking about extra dimensions, that spatial dimensions that were curled up versus the concept of brains that we might be on the three-dimensional spatial surface of a brain that's multi-dimensional. Are there any experiments or observations that we could make in the future that would tell the difference between these two hypotheses?
Yes. So, in fact, there is a possibility, and I won't say likely possibility, because we have to be really lucky, but there's a new particle accelerator being built at CERN, the so-called LHC, for Large Hadron Collider. It's scheduled to turn on in 2007. If we're really lucky, then the LHC will provide evidence for these sort of extra dimensions. But we have to really sort of push our current theories to some sort of corner where the experiments will be detectable. It's not the sort of most likely corner, and it's not the one that's uniquely predicted in any sense. So if we don't see any sign at the LHC, I don't think people will sort of give up on string theory. But if we're lucky, we will see some sign even in the next few years.
There's a question right up there. Yeah, the gentleman very close to you, right over there. And then we'll go up further.
I was just wondering, why does string theory call for so many dimensions?
It's a good question. If you look at a string moving in space, then sort of classically, if you just think of it as a string moving, then it doesn't care how many dimensions space has. And from that standpoint, you know, space might as well just be the three dimensions we see. But it turns out that when you apply quantum mechanics to the string, and you look at this sort of quantum string, there is a particular dimension picked out. The quantum behavior of the string has special properties in one dimension which it doesn't share in any other dimension. And this came as a surprise, because it's the first time that we had a physical theory which actually picked out one dimension of space. In the past, it was always an input. We always put in the fact that, well, particles move in three dimensions and just accepted it as a fact. But here we have a theory which seems to actually be telling us the dimension of space. And it's because strings are, you know, have this preferred dimension when you quantize them that we believe that that dimension is picked out.
There's another question higher up.
This may be a silly question, but is there any reason why it would not make sense to consider the possibility that in your space-time, the time component has more than one dimension, namely the signature is more complicated than the normal?
Yes, so that's not a silly question, because people have wondered about that. If space can have more than three dimensions, can time have more dimensions as well? Although some people have discussed theories with more than one time dimension, the problem they have is that things tend to be very unstable. There is a problem that you have lots of sort of situations where the energy seems to go negative. You don't have anything that you would call a lowest energy or ground state or starting point for your theory. These theories with more than one time, you just can sort of get arbitrary amounts of energy out of anything, pretty much, because the energy can just keep going negative. And that seems very unphysical. And so I think that's why most people don't take those theories seriously.
So I've imposed some asymmetry by taking questions all on this side. Is there anybody on this side? So there's somebody right here.
How would you think that the discovery of the extrasolar planets and maybe possibly more binary pulsars shed maybe stronger confirmations of general relativity, or even maybe give predictions for the future of other alternative theories of gravity, for example?
Okay. Well, the idea that there are extrasolar planets is very exciting, especially in light of, you know, the search for life elsewhere in the universe, but it really doesn't have much to say about general relativity. It doesn't really require a change of our theory of gravity. It doesn't require or even give us an opportunity to test gravity, because planets tend to be, you know, objects where the gravitational fields are rather weak. So it's an exciting thing for astrophysics and for science, but it's not really relevant for gravity. The idea that there could be other binary pulsars, these binary neutron stars, is more interesting from a gravitational standpoint, because that gives us more sources for these gravitational wave detectors that I mentioned. So if you have more examples of these two very dense objects spiraling in toward each other, you'll have many more gravitational waves produced, and we can hopefully see them and analyze them with these gravitational wave detectors.
Okay, we have time for one more question because we have to feed our speaker, otherwise we'll get a bad reputation around here. So this is somebody that's extremely determined down over here. So that better be a good question. That's all.
Thank you, it is. Could you tell us about a work which has gone on to establish, in fact, that the speed of light is constant and not a variable? And what would be the implications if the speed of light is not constant?
I would say that if it was shown that the speed of light was not constant, it would cause a major change in our thinking about space and time, because as I emphasized, that's a cornerstone of special relativity, and special relativity is a cornerstone of general relativity, and so it would really shake everything up. But I don't think there's any evidence that the speed of light is not constant. I can't quote offhand all the experiments which have been done, but people have been measuring the speed of light now for centuries, and there's various sophisticated ways to do that, and the evidence is very good that it's constant.
Very good. I would like to thank our speaker once again for a very stimulating talk.